He would not say, today you'll be with me in paradise, if he wasn't going to be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth.
He was not abandoned to Hades. No, I'm so sorry. Oh my goodness, John, I don't even understand this.
We can literally go from the giants to the divine council to the resurrection of Christ in one episode. Welcome to Kingdoms Unveiled, where we are pulling back the curtain on the clutter of things that remove, I think, the glory and the wonder of Jesus Christ. And specifically today is one of those where we are going to be pulling back the supernatural and seeing the wonder of what Christ did when he descended into the lower regions of the earth, or as some would say, into hell, as our creed says. Your hosts today are Doug Van Dorn, who is the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado in Boulder, Colorado. And you can learn more about Doug at douglasvandorn.com. And I am John Moffitt. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And if you want to learn more about me, just go to Doug's website as well. No, I'm kidding. You can go to theocast.org.
I do have them all linked there.
You do have them all linked there. That's right. No, you have a lot of resources there. I mean, the man has put all of his sermon notes for his entire life on there, and they are extensive with footnotes. I'm always impressed. So you should go there.
On our church website. So,
which is, I guess, it's linked to it, is my point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Doug, this is one I've been pretty excited about. I said this before we started, that I've been wanting to record this episode, I think, from day one. You and I were having conversations about things that we could potentially record. And this is one that I wanted to definitely cover because it's significant to our faith. Well, I think everything we talk about is significant to our faith. I don't feel like we waste our time with things that don't matter. But this one is special, mostly because I think if you've grown up not around the creeds and the confessions, this is one that people reject the creeds over because they think it's strange that Jesus descended into hell or descended into the lower regions of the earth, and that we'll just ditch the creed altogether because, well, we just don't like that phrase. And then the idea of Jesus going into hell, that is, you know, some people, that is just blasphemous. Well, we want to explain that it's not just a interesting part of the Bible, but that's very significant to our faith and very important to it. Doug has done anywhere close to four sermons that surround this subject. I've personally done two so far. We'll put all of those in the show notes if you want to go listen to them. We did them just recently. I think you did them back in earlier this year, and I was just a couple of months ago.
Recently, but over the years,
right.
Yeah.
Over the years, that's right. Oh, and I just noticed that you changed hats to promote the Broncos. I see that.
this is a Bronco hat from their first Super Bowl victory.
Dude, check it out.
Look at this. I still have all the
sticker on it.
Sticker on it, everything.
Look at you. Not much to celebrate lately, but I don't even know. I've been paying attention to the NFL. I've been a Colts fan since I've been like 7 years old. And so we had a lot to celebrate, and now not so much. This is not about football. Moving on. The underworld, Doug. Sometimes I even like to tell people, do you know the world? The world that we live in is hollow. And then they think I've lost my mind.
Hollow Earth, baby.
Hollow Earth. But we're going to talk about the underworld, and it's a very important part of our Old Testament theology that plays into the reason why Jesus fulfills and mentions so many prophecies concerning his descent. So, Doug, talk to us a little bit about, let's set this up first, the ancient Hebrews' understanding of what happens when they died.
Okay, so maybe one thing to talk about before that would be, especially because it's a Reformed podcast, and This is a hard one for a lot of Reformed people, and I don't know that they know exactly why, but if you go and read the Heidelberg Catechism, and then you go and read Calvin in the Institutes, especially Institutes 2:16, 8, and then 10, You'll find that they both describe the descent, quote unquote, descent into hell as really being just Jesus's torment on the cross. Now, the Heidelberg Catechism comes after Calvin,
right?
You know, by a couple of decades. So Calvin was really the source of this, and you can find this in the literature that actually Luther did not believe that at all. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me be a little bit more clear. It's not that it's wrong to say Jesus experienced hellish torment on the cross. Of course he did. And that might be an understatement. Worse than anyone else has ever done, because
that's right.
Was forsaken by the Father.
That's right.
But prior to Calvin, this was not what was meant by the descent into hell. If you go and you read the creeds on this, you'll see that there's a very specific order, and he doesn't descend into hell and then die. Rather, he dies and then descends into hell.
Mm-hmm.
So Calvin was basically reinterpreting this, and in fact, it was completely novel in church history. Nobody had ever taken this view before. I found several scholars that said that in some academic papers.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I think this is where it comes from, but that's kind of why I think we have, as Reformed people, hang-ups about this one. It's because this was the tradition that we really inherited from the Institutes and the Heidelberg Catechism. That doesn't mean that they're necessarily wrong in and of themselves, but what it means is that when we're hearing our guys talk about this, many times they're just going back to Calvin. They're just repeating the tradition of the Reformed, and then they're not going any deeper at all. Sam Renahan has done a great job.
That's right.
On a book on this that kind of goes into to great depths on the history of this, especially since Calvin in the Reformed tradition. So we would both recommend that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's called A Primer and Reader on the Descent of Christ, if you want to look it up.
Yeah.
And to your point, Sam does first an exegetical explanation of the creed and the passages that correlate, and then he goes throughout history and shows you the perspective. This is not new to history, and where a lot of it can be defended from the early church fathers.
Right. So very, very good resource. As far as the Old Testament understanding of this, you know, you'll read scholars saying that they didn't really know much about heaven and hell, and I think that that's probably overstating the case a little bit. Clearly, the New Testament says much more. There was a lot of development in the way that the Jews thought about this, thanks to both going into Babylon, but then also the Hellenization, and then picking up some Greek culture that helped them, I think, codify their thoughts on the afterlife. And I don't think that that's necessarily wrong, because I think that we find the roots of heaven and hell in the Old Testament. And we'll kind of go through that as we talk about it. But essentially,
right,
John, the view was in the Old Testament that everybody, when they died, went to Sheol. It didn't matter if you were righteous or wicked. Everybody went there. This is really important to understand. And the second thing that's important to understand, it might be even more important, is that every single time the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, translates Sheol, which would be the watery pit or the grave, it always translates it with the word Hades every single time. So in other words, Hades is Sheol. Sheol is Hades. Now, when we bring that word into English, we get the word hell. So this means that Sheol and Hades and hell are all identical. But there's a problem, which is that there's two other Greek words that we unfortunately also only translate as hell, and they're not the same place. So one of those words is Gehenna, and this is kind of this lake of fire, eternal lake of fire idea. We translate that as hell, and it gives you the impression when you're reading the New Testament that hell and Hades and Gehenna are the same thing, and they're not, because we only use one word.
That's right.
There's a third place that's translated as hell one time in the New Testament. It's called Tartarus. And what we'll see there is that this was actually viewed as a very specific, very low prison region of Hades. So my point being that our translations aren't necessarily helping our theology of hell, because the Greek and the Hebrew conception of it was a little bit more rich than what we have.
A lot more rich. So we're going to get into that here in just a minute. Just to save time, if you want to know all of these verses, we would recommend Sam's book, or you can go and listen to our sermons. But there are multiple names that are used for the under earth, the underworld, right? For the dead, the pit, the abyss, the lower parts of the earth are all are descriptors of Sheol in the Old Testament. So a little bit, Doug, sometimes when we think about this, we think, oh, well, everyone in the Bible, when they die, the bad people go down and the good people go up. Right? That's how we always describe it.
Let me say this, and I think you would agree with this. After the resurrection, that's true.
That's right.
So what we're doing there is we're reading post-resurrection theology into the Old Testament, and something massive happened in order to make that true, and it wasn't true prior to that event.
That's right. So I want to show just a couple of passages that the Old Testament, the Hebrews, believed that when they died, they actually went into Sheol, and that eventually we learn that this is the place of paradise, or Abraham's bosom, as it's described. So here is a verse where we know for sure that the wicked go to Sheol. This is Psalm 9:17. The wicked shall return to Sheol, all the nations that forget God. Cool. But we also know that the righteous end up going to Sheol as well. This is Ecclesiastes 9:10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. And then Genesis 37, this is significant. This is Jacob upon hearing of Joseph's death. Notice how long he will mourn until. So this is Genesis 37, 35. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, no, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning. Thus his father wept for him. So I don't believe that Jacob thought Joseph was burning in hell, burning in some fiery pit called Sheol. So then we have to say, then there is definitely more to the story of Sheol. And as you read the Bible, you begin to realize that there are it's compartmentalized. And the Bible will speak of these compartments, such as Deuteronomy 32:22, when it says, for a fire is kindled by my anger, it burns to the depths of Sheol. Well, pretty sure Joseph and Jacob are not burning in Sheol right now. At that time, they were not burning in Sheol. So then there seems to be a lower part, a lower region that houses God's anger and his wrath. Abaddon is used in the Old Testament. Psalm will mention this. The pit is described in the New Testament. You will hear it's the abyss. Or Tartarus is what's used. Peter talks about this. Job speaks of the fire that consumes as far as Abaddon. And then even the God who's over the great pit. This is his title. There's not a lot known about that from Job, but it is describing that there seems to be this lower pit, this lower region. There's a divide between the two.
Yeah, there's a... It's like there's compartments. It's interesting. Hezekiah says when he thinks he's going to die, he says, in the middle of my days, I must depart. I am consigned to the gates of Sheol, or the gates of hell, for the rest of my years. And so there you have a little bit of geography. Then you have like Isaiah 26, very cryptic, but he says, your dead shall live. Their bodies will rise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy. For you do as the dew of light. And the earth will give birth to the dead. Come, my people, enter your chambers and shut your doors. Okay, so when you come to like 4th Ezra, it says in Hades, the chambers of the souls are like the womb. And then it, you know, it kind of starts discussing this. So you get a little bit of development of the geography of the place that's starting to say there are compartments, there's gates to it. There's depths to it, like you said. There's prison area, there's non-prison area, there's burning, there seems to be not burning. So there, and this is all Old Testament stuff that you can find. So there's a little bit more there than what people want to admit.
Yeah, and again, a lot of it is, this is good systematic theology. You know, if you look at scripture and kind of pull everything together about the afterlife and the underworld or Sheol, whatever you want to do, and you start looking at all of these passages, you can accumulate a knowledge that says, wow, I think there's more going on than I realized, because you can't have a righteous and a wicked person in the same location, and one of them's describing fiery pit, and the other one is, it says Abraham heard the gospel and he believed. There's no way that Abraham, and it says that Abraham longed to go to be with his people, to go down is what it says in Genesis. He longed to go down to be with his people. So a righteous man cannot be going down and receiving the wrath and anger of God. That just goes against everything we know in scripture.
And it's not just going down into a grave, you know, 3 feet under the ground. You're talking about their soul going there. I found more that I don't know if you've come across. This is from Josephus. Now, this is helping you see the development of the thought. Remember, the Pharisees and Sadducees had one huge difference, and that was that the Pharisees believed in the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's Josephus describing the Pharisees' belief about this place. That he says that souls have an immortal vigor in them, and that under the earth there will be rewards or punishments according as they have lived virtuously or viciously in this life. And the latter are to be detained in an everlasting prison, but the former shall have power to revive and live again.
Interesting. I have not seen that.
I mean, yeah, that's contemporary thinking with the New Testament writers. And so I think it's important to see that these are ideas that are circulating all around. And this would have been the worldviews that the New Testament would have had.
All right, so this is there's a whole lot more verses we could use, but I think this is enough to say there is a clear argument that when you died prior to Christ's resurrection, the belief of the saints was that they were going to go to a place, eventually the title we learn is paradise. Jesus is the one who gives us that paradise. Or Abraham's bosom, Jesus also gives us that title. So those are the two titles that eventually and then we're going to learn here in the text that there seems to be some caverns. When you get into Luke, you can see that, again, this idea of there being a place for the wicked and a place for the righteous. This is Luke 8:30. Jesus is talking about this man that's demon-possessed. And Jesus then asks him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. And they begged him not to command them to depart to the abyss. Right? So there you have this lower region again, the title of it being the abyss. Tartarus is another one, which would be 2 Peter 2:4. So now we're in the New Testament, and the New Testament is continuing to help us understand this perspective. "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell," Tartarus, "and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until judgment." So, Doug, this is we're about to get to the point where, okay, so we definitely have a theology that there's something going on, whether it's an upper or lower, and that both the New Testament and the Old Testament are introducing this to us. I'm going to go ahead and jump ahead a little bit. Before Doug and I want to spend the latter half of this podcast on the theology of why Jesus needed to go there and what was happening.
Maybe we should do one more thing, John, as it comes to my head. Luke gives us this idea of paradise. And I think some people, this can also be confusing for people, because when Jesus is on the cross and then there's the thief there, right? He says, "Today you will be with me in paradise." And a lot of people will go, "See, that proves that it's heaven."
Yeah.
He's going to heaven.
Yep.
But the thing is, we have all kinds of contemporary books and whatever that actually talk about paradise being a place in Sheol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yes, there's a paradise in heaven. We learned that later from the Apostle Paul. To be present with the Lord to die is to be present with the Lord and then in paradise. But there was also a place called paradise that was part of Hades hell, which was different than this place of burning, consignment, you know, torture, and whatever. And I think we can see that in the story. I call it a story. I don't call it a parable.
Yeah.
Story of Lazarus and the rich man, right?
Well, that's where I wanted to go next. So before you read that story, there are two connections I want to make. So I'll read these two, and then I'll throw it over to you so we can talk about the rich man and Lazarus. Jesus makes a very important statement in Matthew 12:40. He says, talking to the disciples, "For just as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth." Now he says the heart of the earth. This is very important to understand. That being said, when he looks at the thief on the cross in Luke 23, he would not say, "Today you'll be with me in paradise," if he wasn't going to be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth, right? So those are all really important connections, and that Jesus is telling them, I'm going to be somewhere for 3 days. And then he looks at the thief on the cross and says, you're going to be there with me. That being said,
let's point out that the heart of the earth, again, that's not talking about Jesus being buried and his body being there. Mm-mm. I don't know what it is. It's almost like people think that when Jesus dies, he doesn't have a soul and it doesn't go anywhere.
Like he goes into it. Some people say he went to heaven, and I was like, well, it didn't say that.
So if he went to heaven, then that destroys the heart of the earth thing.
Right. But
the heart of the earth, like that's talking about Sheol itself, right? This isn't
that's right.
a grave of a body that's shallowly being buried, you know, in some tomb somewhere.
Right.
Because the thief's body isn't going to be buried with Jesus.
No. So what we're going to do next is we're going to talk about the divide in Sheol and why Jesus could be there and he's not being tormented. And then we're going to talk about what Jesus was doing there and why it's significant. So let's talk about Luke 16, Doug.
Yeah, so it's a story of the rich man and Lazarus. I will point out something here, which is that there's several parts of this story that have correspondence in real life. And I view that this story is almost subversion. So Jesus is almost like he's changing names or changing some ideas here, but that people would have been like, well, why does he have five kids or whatever, you know? Why is this guy named Lazarus? I mean, there's no other parable that has this kind of detail to it.
Detail, that's right.
Because it's subversive. Jesus is being deliberately subversive. Because Caiaphas the high priest had five sons. And everybody knew that. And they would all end up eventually ruling one after the other. And there's a fellow named Lazarus, who we all know from John's gospel, actually died. And Jesus raised him from the dead. And I'm not saying that, what I'm saying is that in the telling of this story, it's just really interesting that you have these facts here that I'm not saying that it's telling you exactly what happened, but it's telling you things that could have happened. And it's telling you things that are real places mm-hmm. and real people and events that Jesus is just very cryptically doing some stuff. You know, the whole point of telling the story is to say, look, they wouldn't believe it even if a man come and rises from the dead, right? That's the punchline of the story. And so, well, somebody does rise from the dead, and curiously, his name is Lazarus. And they don't believe him, and they want to kill him too, again, a second time, right? Right. And of course, then Jesus is the one who ultimately rises from the dead, and they certainly don't believe that. And so that leads to all the rest of the problems with the leadership of the Jewish people after that. But,
right. Right.
You know, in that story, he talks about a chasm, right? He talks mm-hmm. about Abraham's bosom and then this place of fiery torment that the rich man goes to. And they can talk to each other. So Abraham That's right. is Abraham's over there and he's talking. He's in Abraham's bosom is what they called it. This is the equivalent of this word paradise.
That's right.
We would both argue paradise is Abraham's bosom. Mm-hmm. It's not a place of burning and torment. It's a giant land. I look at it like a country, you know, it's a giant land. It's got all kinds of places, compartments, mm-hmm. you know, people go different parts of it. And the place of burning is not the same place that Lazarus went to. He went to something yeah. very different.
Speaking of, so in verse 25, it says this, Luke 16:25, but Abraham said, child, remember that in your lifetime received your good things and Lazarus in like manner, bad things, but now he is comforted here and you are in anguish. So he just created here and you. And besides all of this, continue to quote, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able to, and none may cross from here. So some people would say, John, this is just it's like a parable. It's a story. It's not reality. And I'm like, this better be true, because otherwise I don't know how to make sense of all these people who died in the Old Testament and they all went to the same place, apparently. Other than Jesus pulls back the veil and says, well, this is what it looks like when you go to paradise. And he describes to us that there are caverns, there are divides, there's a section. It's all one place, but there seems to be an upper or lower or region or whatever. And the reason why we mention this story is that it's probably the greatest example of what's happening. He literally kind of peels back and says, this is what's happening. in Sheol before his death, before resurrection. Okay, so that being said, why is this important, Doug? Why is this significant? Why are we talking about this? Why should we see that this should be a part of our theology? Well, there's three reasons. First of all, it is a fulfillment of prophecy. We're going to talk about that here in a minute, according to Psalms, Zechariah. Second, Jesus is doing something very important, significant, related to Genesis chapter 6. We'll get to that. And number three, he is fulfilling something that we get excited about, which is bringing many sons to glory based upon the righteousness that he has provided for us. So we have a couple of passages that we're going to look at. Before I do, I want to read Peter, because Peter makes a statement. This is really kind of what threw me down this trail of wanting to explain this to people. Peter is writing to the church in 1 Peter chapter 3, and well, the whole entire book is suffering. They're on the outskirts of Rome. They're experiencing all kinds of different various trials. And he's in the middle of the letter. He's in the middle of explaining. He just got done. This is how you are to deal with tyrannical bosses, governments, state officials. This is how you're going to deal with them. And to encourage them in their suffering, Doug, he tells them this story about Jesus descending into hell. I mean, it's fascinating to me. I know that you're suffering. I know you're having a hard time. Let me tell you why Jesus descended into hell. So when you tell me it doesn't matter, this stuff is, you guys are fringing it. Not true. The Apostle Peter thought it was significant enough to encourage his people. Let me read. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous. This is 1 Peter 3:18. That he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through water. Baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you, not as a removal of dirt from the body, but as an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, with angels, authorities, powers, having been subjected to him. Okay, now that seems like a lot, but let me summarize. He is saying, I know you're suffering. Christ died on the cross. Remember your baptism. Everything is under his power now. Even so that he went down, and when he died on the cross and he went down into the ground, that was a victory lap for him. He was proclaiming victory over what? Over, apparently, spirits who had tried to stop the redemption plan. And he went down there and said, look, you tried to stop this. I'm winning. I'm victorious. He grabs the keys. He grabs the saints. He takes them to glory. And he says, now everything is under his feet. And I love how Hebrews says this. I know that you don't feel like it's this way, but it is. Everything is under the feet of Jesus. It just hasn't fully played out yet, in that he hasn't come the second time to put everything right. So the whole descent into the under earth, one, is used by Peter as a means of encouragement to the suffering church. So that's one. But number two, it's also used as a very important part of our theology and understanding what Christ accomplished when he ascended on high. So Doug, a little bit. This is a passage we like to go to as really as a proof of one, Genesis 6, 1 through 4 being a spiritual interpretation and not and Peter is using, Peter is using the giant story and the rebellion of the angels who created these giants, Jesus's victory over them. He's using it as an encouragement for the church. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. And it fits also with 2 Peter. Which he also wrote, that talks about these creatures were locked up in Tartarus. Like, that's the Tartarus passage is only mentioned one time, that word, in the New Testament, and it's of the locking up of the watchers into this lowest part of hell. So it fits his theology with the other letter that he wrote, and it makes all the sense in the world that he would use this as an encouraging kind of a thing. You know, we have a prophecy that a lot of people don't understand this, but it's Psalm 24.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this great prophecy of who's going to ascend the hill of the Lord. And before he ascends the hill of the Lord, he has to go to some gates. And at the end, I mean, this is made famous, of course, by Handel and the Messiah. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. And then comes a response. Who is the King of Glory? And then the answer is the Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. And then, of course, it repeats it again. Now, for whatever reason, a lot of people think that these gates are the gates of heaven, the pearly gates. But that doesn't make any sense. Why would the gatekeeper of the pearly gates be like, well, who is this? And then he's like, well, it's the Lord mighty in battle. Well, he doesn't need to do any battle in heaven. No. This is the gates of hell that he is storming. And these gatekeepers are the demonic underworld horde powers that have the keys to this place. And the King of Glory is coming in order to do battle against them. And his name is the Lord of Hosts, the Lord Sabaoth. He is the King of Glory. And so it's this great prophecy that in order to ascend the hill of the Lord, first he must descend, go to the gates of hell, take those keys and get the keys so that he can empty the place out according to the prophecy that we find in Psalm 68. Now, there's one thing, you know, maybe you want to go to read Psalm 68 or something, but one thing to bring out here is that, and I don't know if this was what was going through Calvin's mind or not, that made him have this view. Jesus did not go to hell to suffer for anything.
Nope. It was a victory lap, according to Peter. He proclaimed victory.
Yeah, he didn't go to suffer on our behalf. There was no suffering whatsoever. He went down there in order to conquer the place, in order to basically, as Peter says, proclaim his victory to the underlords of the underworld, and then to say, I'm here, there's nothing you can do about it, you killed me, you thought that was going to do the job, ha ha ha, joke's on you. Give me the keys, I'm going to go let the prisoners out that was promised long ago.
Yeah, Revelation 7, he has the keys of death and Hades.
Exactly.
He holds them.
And that's where the change all occurs. This is the reason why believers no longer go to Sheol, Hades, hell.
That's right.
Even to the good side, the Elysium, the sleepiness, or whatever. We don't go there. We go to be in the presence of the Lord forever because our Jesus has won that victory for us, and he released the captives. I mean, even there's that weird verse in Matthew, remember, where all of a sudden all the graves are opened these dead people are walking around proclaiming the gospel. You know, it's like this throwaway verse. Well, what's the point of that? It's showing that these people have been freed and released from their prison. Because this is another really important point, is that why would they need to go to this place? Okay, it's because justification had not been won for the human race. Yes, Paul says in Romans 3, God in his forbearance, allowed them to be forgiven. But something actual, physical, and historical had to take place first in order for God to truly justify in a once-for-all way the righteousness that belonged to them and that they were justified by through faith in the Old Testament. And that was that somebody had to come along and actually obey the law perfectly.
That's right.
And well, until that point, it was a holding place. It wasn't a place of punishment, but it was a holding place because justice had to be met before they could be released because they were sinners themselves.
And they needed required righteousness. So like, where does it say, Paul says, where the first Adam failed, the second Adam succeeded. I love this in Romans. You know, when I was a kid, we'd always, Romans 3, when it says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We always think that as like missing the mark, but that's not what the point is. To be in the glory of God requires righteousness, not sinlessness.
That's the divine counsel passage you brought up last week with Joshua,
right,
and the high priest, and Satan and the angel of the Lord arguing over him, and he clothes him with his righteousness.
That's right, and he deserves to be there.
That's a courtroom scene that you brought up last time, that there has to be some kind of an official courtroom act that allows, a heavenly courtroom act, that the angels themselves are witness to, that allows God to, in his justice, free sinners, even sinners that were had faith in him from that place and bring them to heaven. And that's the righteousness that we have in union with Christ, because he's now the living savior of you know, his people.
That's right. So he withholds his wrath. He keeps them in a safe place that is described as paradise, because what is required, what was required, is the risen Lord's righteousness is what's required, right? And so there's, it's important. This is a beautiful prophecy by Zechariah 9:9. Listen to this. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. I mean, how awesome is that, right? So he's already prophesying that. Then you go to verse 11. As for you also, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I will set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Whoa, come on. Well, why is he going to do that? Because they're held there because they need righteousness to be in the presence of the Father, right? So this is, there's this sermon by, we're not going to read the whole thing, but there's a sermon by Peter in Acts chapter 2, which is related to Psalm 68. And what is it that David prophesies, and what does he declare, right? I'll just read it. This is Peter quoting David. So Acts 2:25, for David says concerning him, I saw the Lord always before me, for he is on my right hand and not forsaken me. Therefore, my heart was glad and my tongue rejoiced. My flesh also will dwell in hope, for you will not abandon my soul to Hades or let your Holy One see corruption. You have made known to me the paths of life. You will make the full of gladness with your presence. So he is speaking of this very thing, the same thing as Zechariah, that there is coming a day when the Messiah will come and he will bring David out of this place of paradise. But, so he says, go ahead.
But Peter is applying what you're talking about in terms of the release of David and all the other Old Testament saints. He's actually applying it directly to Jesus, the son of David.
That's right.
And there's a direct inescapable implication where it says in Acts 2:31, David foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ.
The Christ, that's right.
He was not abandoned to Hades. Now, that's sorry. Oh my goodness, John, I don't even understand this. I found so many commentators that were like, there's no proof whatsoever that Jesus ever went to hell. I'm like, what, have you never read the song?
Acts 2?
Have you never read the sermon of Peter? He literally says that God would not abandon his soul to Hades. How does directly imply that Jesus was in Hades?
That's right.
Because to be abandoned and not be abandoned in place means you have to have been there in the first place. Right? I mean, I just don't get it. So this one is like, to me, this is the nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
That yes, Jesus went to Hades. And this whole point of this Psalm 16:10 is that the reason why they're released from this place is because he did not let his soul see flesh see corruption, and he was raised from the dead, and therefore in him all who are in Christ, Old Testament or New Testament, are raised out of that place.
Amen.
It's so Hebrews amazing. 2. It's so powerful.
It is. Hebrews 2:10. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. So Jesus is the one who brings them to, and this is, it all makes sense because, you know, now when we die, because we die in faith, we have the righteousness of Christ applied to us immediately. But this is, it's significant when the writer of Hebrews, writing to Jews, right? Writing to those who would understand the Old Testament, writing and telling them there's hope beyond the grave. And now when one dies, they're being brought to glory. Whereas in the Old Testament, well, they were saying, well, I'm going to Sheol. And now the writer of Hebrews is saying, oh no, now because of what Jesus, now if you go back to the old law, you have the old law promises. But if you go to Christ, you have Christ's promises. And what is Christ's promises? That he brings the sons to glory now. They're not just using the law to they never used the law for that. So this is 2 Corinthians 4:16. I found this super helpful and fascinating as well. So we do not lose heart, Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light moment of momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but the things that are unseen. For the things that are unseen are transient, and the things that are seen are eternal. So then he says this in chapter 5. For we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, who is not made with hands, eternal in heaven. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on the earthly dwelling. Indeed, by putting it on, we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not with what would be unclothed, but that what we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by this life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the spirit of guarantee. So then he says this, I read all this very long passage, but this is what I want to get to. So we are always of good courage. We know that while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make our aim to please him. This is in retrospect of what Christ has accomplished. But when you read the Old Testament, they don't speak this way, right? They're speaking of it differently. And this is the only reason why we're kind of getting hyped up about this, is that I think it heightens the work of what Christ has done. And it gives a fuller explanation of his righteousness. And in my opinion, covenant theology, where Christ is the second Adam, the covenant of work was fulfilled by Jesus and applied at his resurrection, which is why he goes down to grab these people, proclaim to them, by the way, I did it. I fulfilled the covenant. I not only that, and all of you who tried to stop me, you know, I'm here for my victory lap. And the fulfillment of the covenant of works, he applies the righteousness to them. And this is the hope that Paul is saying. Those of us who are waiting, we still have this hope. We are not going to be abandoned. We still have the righteousness of Christ that will be applied to us. So it is important when we confess this creed, this entire podcast of 41 minutes, when you hear the quote and descended into hell, hopefully you have this in mind when you quote the creed next time. Doug, any other thoughts?
It's just such a great doctrine, man. It really is. And when you understand it properly, it just is another piece to the supernatural puzzle. It's a piece to, you know, the understanding the creeds and why it was that the church at the very beginning of days believed this doctrine. It makes sense of these passages that we've looked at, like especially the Psalm 16. And it helps us to understand that, you know, the depths, literally the depths that Jesus went to win our salvation. It's truly mind-blowing to me. And I've found that it's been very helpful for the people that I've been able to teach it to in our church. I've also found that they don't get it the first time necessarily. There's so much to it. Go back and listen to the show a week from now after you've already heard it. And you're probably like, I don't remember hearing that the first time, because that's what happens when you hear something the first time. It's such a mind blow that you're just kind of trying to process it. There's so much here. That's why, you know, I've preached on it several times and I love it. And I get new stuff out of every time that I look into it again. So I hope that this has helped people.
Well, speaking of, I want to throw one more passage out there. And I want to keep saying this too. This is all very much connected to Genesis 6. So if you guys think we're crazy and we spend too much time on the giants, both Peter and Paul are the ones, and Jude for that case, they're the ones who keep pointing back to it. I always skip this part to my own shame, Doug. Ephesians 4. Paul is encouraging the unity of the church and the power of the Spirit that unifies the church, right? And how does he do that? Ephesians 4:8. Therefore, it says, when he descended on high, he led a host of captives and he gave gifts to men. So right there. I mean, again, who are the captives? It's those who are in the grave, who in Sheol. And saying he descended, what does it mean? But that he also descended into the lower regions, the earth.
The earth, yeah. I'm glad you said it that way.
That's right. He who descended is the one who also ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. He is grabbing authority. Look what God has. And then he applies that authority to the church. So the descent, so this victory over the evil spirits and the descent and bringing captives free. This is all supposed to be encouraging the church to do the work of the church. So this isn't nerdy theology so we can fringe out. This is literally for encouragement.
You brought up this as being related to the giants and stuff. Well, go back and read where Paul gets this quote from, that he descended, or he leads a train free of captives. It comes from Psalm 68, and guess what's right in the middle of that psalm? Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon. God is doing something in the face of Mount Hermon, which is where the whole Genesis 6 event took place, and he is pillaging the strong man. The strong man's house is another thing that, you know, that Jesus talks about. He has to pillage the strong man's house, and that was being done on earth through the release of people through demonic activity, but it was also being done when he died, when he went down and literally pillaged the strong man's house and took out those captives and led them into freedom.
So you give Doug and I the chance, we can literally go from the giants to the divine council to the resurrection of Christ in one episode. It's not hard because it's all connected, right? We got to stop fracturing up our Bibles. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. If you were to give us another 2 hours, I guarantee you I could tell you more. But you'll have to come back next week for that. But thanks for listening. This has been an episode I've been longing for a long time. And, you know, maybe we'll circle back to it someday. But hopefully you're encouraged in understanding when the creeds, when we're confessing the creed, and it says that he descended into hell, remember why, what he's doing. He's proclaiming victory. He is gathering the saints, taking them to glory, and he's grabbing the keys to death and Hades. And he comes out, as Colossians says, he disarmed, this is Colossians 2:15, we'll end with this. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him. Why did he put him to shame? Because they tried to stop him and they failed. And that's the shame on them. Doug, as always, encouraged. Thank you, my friend, for joining us. And Lord willing, we'll have another podcast for you guys next week.